Hard to believe that a house in the country could be the inspiration for an album of music. But that's the effect that an old brick farmhouse has had on the musical duo Over the Rhine. Karen Berquist and Linford Detweiler moved there about 8 years ago, and they do a lot of their songwriting now on the back porch.
There's an old swing that belonged to my grandmother that we managed to keep in the family. It's a nice big swing, and Linford will be sitting out there playing the guitar, and something will just strike me, and I'll start humming along. And
we also noticed when we moved out there that there was a certain time in the evening when the light started to change. We started referring to that as our favorite time of light.
It's our favorite time of light.
Over the Rhine, at home in the country, that's next.
This podcast is made possible by listeners who can contribute now at thestory.org and in collaboration by Burt's Bees, Red Hat, and the Redwoods Group Foundation, who believe by working together we can help strengthen communities for a better world.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The notion of home means different things to different people. For some, it's the place you come from and a place you return to. Others search for a place that they want to call home. Others know exactly where it is, and still others find their home somewhat unexpectedly around a turn in the road. Karen Berquist and Linford Detweiler make up the band Over the Rhine.
Just shy of breaking down, there's a bend in the road that I have found called home. Take a left at loneliness, there's a place to find forgiveness.
Well, I was out driving the back roads in Ohio trying to finish a few songs, and I came around a bend in the road, and there was an old brick pre-Civil War farmhouse sitting beneath a few tall trees, a very simple English-looking house, two stories with a row of windows across the top and a row of windows across the bottom, you know, facing into the sunset. And there was a for sale sign stuck in the front yard. It looked like a little farm that had been lost in time. And both Karen and I had been talking about moving out of the city and finding a little refuge from the road. I took Karen out there the next day, and I think she got a little misty-eyed when she saw the place. And we were signing papers not too long after that.
Pre-Civil War brick home. Does that mean red bricks, the kind that I would normally imagine, or something more sort of hand-hewn?
Those were red bricks, and we're told that back in the day that the wagons would have pulled up there and the trees would have come down and they would have gone down to the creek and gotten the clay out, and the masons would have baked the bricks right on site and built that house. And then moved on to the next one.
Built it from the clay that it stands on there, right?
Yeah, just over the hill. I guess they would have typically found a nearby creek and gotten their materials.
Karen, tell me what you were thinking when Linford came back and said, I saw this old brick house in the country.
Well, he liked to go take drives and see things. But this time, I think he secretly had a mission, and it's because we both felt like the chapter was closing where we were living in the city. It was a wonderful urban experience. We'd been there for quite some time, but as we toured from city to city, we found that when we came home, we needed something different. We wanted the sound of birdsong as opposed to car alarms, and just needed a change. And so when he came back from this particular drive, I could tell that he'd stumbled upon something rather special, and the way he was describing it piqued my interest. And I said, well, if we're gonna go look at this place, you know, let's go ahead and call the realtor and see it inside and out. And so we drove out the next day, and it was a lot farther outside of the city than I had expected, so I kept kind of thinking the farther away we got, wow, are we going to still be in Ohio by the time we get to this place? But sure enough, we rounded the bend in the road, and I saw it, and it It was an old, old brick house that looked like it had a lot of character, looked like it had a lot of love in it at some point. I knew it was probably affordable because it was just the right kind of fixer-upper. And we fell in love with it. I knew. And the space around it was so inviting. You know, it was so green and there were rolling fields. And it felt like home. And when I grew up, I'd always rented. You know, I lived with my mom and we'd always lived in apartments. And we never really found a place that felt like home, you know, and this is the first time in my life, you know, where I feel like I'm coming home and I know I'm going to be there for a long time.
What kind of condition was it like inside when you explored it?
Well, a bachelor had lived there for 17 years.
Okay, bad news.
And
yeah.
He was a chain smoker, and he was terrified of mice, and he hadn't been in the house for a while, so he had taken mothballs and just sort of thrown them around the edges of rooms. And when my brother walked in, he said the place smelled like a well-preserved ashtray. But it was beautiful in its own way, and you know, we're not afraid of a few rough edges in our songs or otherwise.
Well, from a woman's perspective, there was, if I recall, there was orange shag carpeting up the stairs that had probably been there for 20 years.
Longer than that.
Not a lot of shag left in that carpet.
No, no. And blue shag carpeting in the mudroom, which smelled like the oil furnace that was kind of a tinkerer's delight, and came with pages and pages of notes, and we're dutifully writing these notes down as the former owner is explaining this thing. And you know, as soon as we signed the contract, I looked at Linford and I said, "That bomb has got to go." and so it was a fixer upper, and Linford and I, well, we're not really handy people, but we can make it sing. And so we just kind of plunged in up to our elbows and
found some neighbors to help out.
Did what we could, and now it feels like a different place. So it doesn't smell like mothballs and an ashtray anymore.
How long had you been calling this place home before you started to think that the music that you were writing was really closely linked to where you were living?
Well, I think with the last record that we'd done just previous to Meet Me at the Edge of the World, we realized that we had a little stack of songs that didn't quite fit that project because they all were directly connected in some way to this little hideaway farm. And so I think, you know, a few years ago we realized that it might be nice to try to gather songs that had grown out of this chapter into one place.
And there's one, Karen, about the edge of the world, which I gather you had something to do with figuring out where that was coming from. Can you tell me the story behind that one?
Well, sometimes when the fog rolls in out there, you look out the window and it looks as if we're just sitting on the edge of the world and there's nothing beyond that line of fog. And so it feels rather surreal and mysterious and special to us. And every day I like to walk my dogs along this path that cuts through the property. And along this path, there's one tupelo tree, and it's a small tree, and it's the only tupelo on the property, and it's a rather special little tree. And every time I get to that point in the walk, I get words or some kind of inspiration or something will move me or catch my attention. So I know I need to be ready with my recorder or at least a notebook or something, and I need to catch that moment. And one day, this song just poured out right there, and I wrote it down, and it was the song that would become the title track for the record, Meet Me at the Edge of the World.
You carry a little recorder with you?
I do. I always have something with me that I can record song ideas, snippets, anything. It's either a recorder or I'll use my iPhone or something. I'm rarely without some kind of device that I can catch that inspiration, because I know if I don't, someone else will get it and make more money with it.
So if I went back to that original recording, the few words that you put down beside the Tupelo tree back when you composed this mm-hmm. song or started composing it for the first time, what would I hear? What would we be listening to if you could play it for me now?
Well, at that moment, it was only words. And sometimes a song reveals itself melodically first. But this time it came strictly poetically, and it was just verse after verse after verse, and it just spilled out.
I don't have a copy of the lyrics in front of me, so what would have been the first words you would have recorded? Just talk me through them.
One lone tupelo stood against the iron weed, the golden rod that tamed our need for something other than fear and greed. Meet me at the edge of the world.
One lone tupelo stood against the iron weed, the golden rod that tamed our need for something other than fear and greed. Meet me at the edge of the world.
That just came to you out on a walk.
Yeah. It doesn't always happen like that,
no,
trust me. Sometimes you have to really work for it. But sometimes they're like little gifts, and you feel like, you know, if you're taking care of your, what I call your signal, if you're taking care of that part of you, it stays open, and you can just tune in and receive these little gifts that come, you know, from the universe or from wherever. And I think that's what happened that day. Then later, I picked up this four-string tenor guitar, which I'm learning to play, and I started to play around with it, and I realized that the verses to Meet Me at the Edge of the World were going to come out musically of that tenor guitar, and it did. It was kind of the strangest thing, but I just ended up writing the whole song on that tenor, and then the choruses sort of poured out after that, and I played it for Linford, and we edited and fine-tuned, and there it is.
Here we stand on cold concrete ground, 'cause someone said they like the sound. I'm thankful that they've hung around, but I'm craving the edge of the world.
Karen Berquist and Linford Detweiler are the musicians in Over the Rhine. Their new home is actually something of a return to the farming life for Linford's side of the family. And we'll hear more about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from APM, American Public Media. This is The Story.
Walk me to the edge of the world. Meet me at the edge of the world.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Karen Berquist and Linford Detweiler are the musical duo that is Over the Rhine. The songs on their latest album celebrate their current home, an 1830s brick farmhouse in southern Ohio.
It's our favorite time of life, just before the day kisses the night. You see the red-winged blackbirds fly, the sun's a big old lazy eye. It's our favorite time of life.
I'm curious to know if either of you had spent any time country living before this. I mean, we picked up the story with you as a couple living in the city, moving to the country, but did either of you mm-hmm. have any experience living on a farm or a long way from a convenience store, that sort of thing?
Well, we were definitely small town kids.
Okay.
And as far as my family history goes, there's a lot of farms back there. And, you know, sometimes I think writers or songwriters, we feel like we step into the middle of a story that's already in progress. And when I think of, you know, my musical path, I have to back up and start with my father, who was born and raised on an Amish farm. In that tradition, musical instruments are forbidden, except for the harmonica. We're not sure why that exception was made.
Okay.
But my father was a bit of an artistically inclined child. He sketched drawings on the side of the whitewashed barn, and folks would sort of gather around and look at his drawings and recognize their faces. And he and his brother were also very interested in music, but they weren't allowed to have musical instruments, as I mentioned. And so they got their hands on a secret guitar and hid it in the barn. They buried it in the hay mow. And one of the other brothers, not knowing it was there, accidentally ran a pitchfork through it one day. And that was the end of the guitar. And
did your dad get in trouble with the elders for doing his barnside drawing or playing his guitar?
Well, I never really heard any problem with the drawings. It was more of a curiosity. And my, you know, uncles would tell these stories, and they were sort of just fascinated by this side of him. I'm sure they got in trouble for hiding the guitar in there. But, you know, there's a similar story on my mother's side of the family. She was growing up on an Amish farm as well. Same kind of thing. No musical instruments allowed. And she wanted a piano when she was a little girl. And one of her school teachers actually helped her cut out a cardboard keyboard and color the keys. And she took this little cardboard keyboard home with her and would sit in her bedroom and play this music that could only be heard inside of her. And so this idea that music could be dangerous or be careful, you know, was sort of part of my family history.
How is it that you didn't wind up on an Amish farm if your folks were both there? What happened?
Well, my grandfather offered the farm to my dad when he turned 21 if he would only stay and farm it, and it would have made him a wealthy man. But he said the only thing he knew for sure when he was 21 was that he wasn't a farmer. So he gracefully bowed out and became a bit of an explorer and met my mother. And I kind of like to think, you know, the chapter of his life that ensued could be referred to, you know, as Let the Music Be Heard. Mm-hmm. Because he bought a record player. Mm-hmm. And eventually had six of us kids and would often play records in the evening. And he didn't know it was against the rules to play, you know, Eddie Arnold, Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, and Mahalia Jackson all in the same evening. You know, he had really eclectic tastes. We grew up around a lot of great music, and when he discovered that I was a musical kid, he got the classified ads out and circled all the used pianos for sale. And we went around town, and he let me play all the pianos and decide which one I thought was the right piano. And we paid $10 for it and brought it home and put it right in the middle of the living room. So that's where I went as a kid to figure out stuff that I didn't have words for.
Did you travel a lot as a family when you were growing up?
We certainly did.
They moved. At least we've lost count, but we were trying to count at one of the family reunions, and I think it's roughly 28 times.
Oh,
so he was restless, you know. And
my father wasn't afraid to open the atlas and look at Western Montana and just kind of ponder the atlas for a while and say, you know what, I bet it's really pretty out there. We should go check it out. And we did. I like to say now, he was a very spiritual person. I like to say that, you know, he was looking for a city not made with human hands, and we looked over a lot of horizons.
Mm-hmm. He was inspirational, and he loved the farm that we live on now. And when he came to see it, He said he heard birdsong that he hadn't heard since he was a child on the farm in Delaware. And he would tell us what the bobwhite sounded like and point it out and the other calls. And he loved mocking birds. And there's a song on the record about him that I wrote. I kind of thought Linford would write this song, but it came out of me for some reason. And it's the song Against the Grain.
Rolling black skies made a big impression on you. Ooh. 200 rolling acres singing in sheep no blues. Swinging high, rolling low, doesn't much matter which way we go. Outbound train moving fast and slow. Hey. Shotgun with you.
Ooh. What's interesting to me is listening to you talk about your growing up, Linford, makes it so clear why your discovery one afternoon of this farmhouse somewhere was like the answer to a question that perhaps you hadn't asked yourself. It's like, whoa, home. A place I can call home.
That's a really eloquent way of saying it. Thank you. But that kind of snuck up on us. But this record, Meet Me at the Edge of the World, is very much about finding a place, a home. There's almost a homesickness on the record, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And my father had some advice for us when he saw this little place that we were in the process of starting to fix up. He encouraged us to leave the edges wild. Isn't that great? It became kind of a metaphor for us. He wanted the birds to have their, you know, secret hidden places for their untamed music. And Leave the Edges Wild became kind of a way of thinking about our writing or the way we wanted to live. And that line actually shows up in about three different songs on the record.
Sketching familiar faces on the board. Weight washed by the dawn. Against the grain, leave the edges wide. Come now, child.
What did he mean by that, though? I mean, did he mean don't you know, cut all the bushes down, keep the bushes
right
close?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let the weeds and the wildflowers
mm-hmm.
and the woods. You just leave some wild edges, and I'm so glad we did.
I am, too. We have so many beautiful wildflowers that, you know, most people consider weeds, but they've become important to me. They end up in my songs. You know, the ironweed is one of the most striking, beautiful purple colors you'll see in nature, and it's blooming right now at the farm, and it's one of my favorite flowers.
Learning to call things by name out on this place was a really big part of this chapter. When we moved out there, we didn't know what to call anything. There'd be these amazing birds singing over our shoulders, you know, and we didn't know it was an indigo bunting or a house finch or, you know, a bobwhite or
a bluebird.
Or a bluebird, right.
Do you get the Carolina mm-hmm. wren that far north?
We do.
They like our porch and they scream like crazy at our dogs.
But they sing. They're so
but they
really
have a beautiful
they have
song.
A beautiful song. Yeah.
They do.
There was one holding forth this morning out there.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, bird watchers, it's very rock and roll.
Baby, this is no way. How sweet it is to find. Baby, this is no way. How sweet it is to find. Now that we are finally here, no way suits me fine. I'm crazy for you, baby. I hope that you can see. I'm crazy for you, baby. I hope that you can see. I
disappear. Here ain't no way I'd rather be.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking with the musicians Karen Burquist and Linford Detweiler. Their band is Over the Rhine. In your songs on Meet Me at the Edge of the World, though, several times you refer to your farm as nowhere. And before I had a chance to talk to you while I was listening to the music, I was wondering if that was an affectionate way of referring to the farm, or if sometimes you really feel cut off from everywhere. Where does how do you use that word?
Well, it does feel at times like it's in the middle of nowhere, especially when I'm in a hurry to get there. But we also refer to it as now here, depending on your perspective.
That's been a fun concept to play with. I guess we found out later that's a sort of a Zen discipline, the idea of nowhere. But yeah, Nowhere Farm, now here. There's songs on the record that we've sort of messed around with that idea. There's a song called Baby If This Is Nowhere, and it's been a fun idea to play with.
My grandfather used to use the phrase the back of beyond to talk about places.
That's nice.
Oh, that's,
you know, like nowhere.
We might steal that. Be careful.
Yeah, that's
you can have
beautiful.
It. You would be honored.
The back of beyond. We're going to fight over that one, I want you to know. We're very competitive when it comes to songwriting ideas. And, yeah.
So leave me with a picture. When you're working together, because you sing so beautifully together, when you do that, is there a place in the house where you like to work together? Is there one room or a back porch? Where do you play?
Oftentimes it is the back porch. There's an old swing that belonged to my grandmother that we managed to keep in the family. It's a nice big swing, and Linford will be sitting out there playing the guitar, and something will just strike me, and I'll start humming along, and we end up singing together, and sometimes I have to go finish the song in the shower. It's a really great place to finish a song.
We also noticed when we moved out there that there was a certain time in the evening when the light started to change. And we would sort of beckon to each other to come out and check this out, because it felt like something sacred was happening. The fields would start to sort of glow. And we started referring to that as our favorite time of light. And that's another title of a song that ended up on the project. And oftentimes, you know, we end up out on the back porch during that time of day.
We try to shut things down. There are a couple of things that we'll stop and drop everything for, one of which is that time of day, which we call our favorite time of light. And the other thing is when the full moon rises out there. There are some low rolling hills, but it's pretty flat. And when the moon comes up and it's full, it'll stop you in your tracks. And so we'll try to, you know, look up the schedule and get the time right, and we'll pull our chairs out to the edge of the fence line and make sure we've got the right view.
It's big doings.
It's a big deal out there for us. We will drop everything for the moonrise.
If the moon fell from the sky and the rain, everything black and I'd want you. I'd want you. If the stars fell like snow, tumbling tiny angels with wings, I'd want you. I will
Karen Berquist and Linford Detweiler of Over the Rhine. Their latest album is called Meet Me at the Edge of the World. Dick Gordon from APM, American Public Media. This is The Story.
Support for The Story comes from Burt's Bees, natural health and beauty care on a mission to make people's lives better naturally for over 25 years. Burt'sBees.com. And Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. This past weekend, people across the country marked 50 years since the bombing of a church in Birmingham, Alabama. In mid-September 1963, four little girls attending Sunday school were killed in an explosion which is still regarded as a turning point in the fight for civil rights. There's an interesting footnote to the commemoration. The 16th Street Baptist Church was designed by a black architect at a time when it was extremely difficult for African Americans to succeed in that profession. His name was Wallace Rayfield, and much of what's known about him today is a story of chance. And it goes like this. 20 years ago, Alan Dura and his friend Danny were planning to demolish an old barn outside Birmingham. Alan was ready to bring in a bulldozer, but Danny wanted to see if there was anything inside to salvage.
We could see off at a distance some metal boxes, and some of them were open, and the floor was so rotten that as I began to make my way back to them, I actually fell through the floor and skinned my leg up.
Put your foot right through the floorboards, you mean?
Right, and it was only about 2 feet off of the dirt, but that was enough to go through and hurt pretty good. So that made me more determined just to leave them in the old barn. And if it had not been for Danny and his insistence on getting those out of there, they would have for sure been left in that barn.
You mean you would have bulldozed the remains of the barn down on top of those boxes?
Right. Would have buried them.
How many boxes were there, Alan? I mean,
there were 10 metal boxes, and they were of a size of about 14 inches by maybe 20 inches. And Danny insisted on getting these out, so he said he would go around to the back of the barn because they were stacked in a back corner against the wall, and he would pull off some boards back there and we could get them out through the back of the barn. Well, as Danny went around, again, very carefully made my way back towards them, trying to be sure that I stepped on the floor joist and not just on the floorboards. Made my way back there, and upon arriving, saw that these were not rubber stamps after all. They were metal plates, printing plates, mounted on wooden blocks. And I could see beautiful drawings of churches, of schools, had floor plans, had elevation drawings, and even had portraits of individuals. And these individuals appeared to be African American. And on the tops of the boxes, there were inscriptions such as W.A. Rayfield and Company, School Architects, Birmingham, Alabama. Another box would say W.A. Rayfield and Company, Church Architects, Birmingham, Alabama. And this really aroused a curiosity in me, but by the same token, curiosity was all that it was at that point. And I took them like frisbees and threw them out into the, actually a cow pasture behind the barn, where Danny picked them up and put them in boxes and transferred them to a building close by.
Alan Dura says at one point he was ready to take the plates off to the dump, but he kept them. Years passed, and one day he got curious again and started calling around to see if anyone had ever heard of this Rayfield character. He was finally referred to Marjorie White at the Birmingham Historical Society.
And I told them what I had found and what the portraits looked like, looking like African-American people, and they, whoever it was I was talking with, and I think that was Dr. Marjorie White, literally screamed on the phone, saying that they had been searching for over 20 years trying to find anything pertaining to Rayfield's life and works, and virtually could not, other than a few cornerstones on a few church buildings. Well, as it turned out, Dr. Marjorie White wanted to come out to my home immediately and examine the printing plates. And she arrived right at dark. And the enthusiasm and the excitement that she demonstrated as she picked them up and looked at them made me realize that, hey, this is something apparently extremely important. It's not just some casual find of old junk.
So who was this guy?
Rayfield was America's second and Alabama's first formally educated and practicing black architect. Architecture was a trade that very few blacks entered into at that time. If a parent had enough money to send a son, and usually it would be a son as opposed to a daughter, to a higher education school, they usually would invest that money in the education of a doctor or a lawyer rather than the idea of an architect. So for Rayfield to be trained as an architect in that day was an exceptional thing.
Alan, can you give me an example of the kind of building that he would have been designing and roughly when? I mean, what are we talking about here? Turn of the century, early 1900s?
Early 1900s, one of the most notable buildings, not necessarily from an architectural standpoint, but because of what the building itself has come to represent, is the 16th Street Baptist Church, which most everyone who is familiar with it is familiar with it having been bombed in the 60s.
That's the one where the four little girls were killed in the bombs, the dynamite set by the Klan, right?
Exactly. And of the many, many buildings that were designed by Rayfield that did not necessarily carry a cornerstone, this building carries a big, beautiful cornerstone that states W.A. Rayfield and Company Architects. And it is a magnificent building.
All right, so help me with something then, Alan. You're a Baptist preacher yourself and a piano tuner and the owner of music stores, and somebody comes up to you and says, you've come across this a real wonderful collection of old plates of an architect that we've been looking for. Did you just hand them all over to Dr. White and say, yeah, take them away, see what you can find out about this guy?
Actually, Marjorie portrayed an attitude that made me feel like she expected me to just surrender these to her. And if I had been a little bit more naive, I probably would have. But picking up on the fact that she was so ecstatic about it, and then also with the interviewers from Channel 6 and the Birmingham News coming out, I began to realize more and more that this was not only something extremely valuable from a historical standpoint, but it also apparently was very valuable from a monetary standpoint, and seemed to be one of those rare things that you hear about on the Antique Roadshow, where somebody finds a rare painting or a rare antique. And here this was not just a painting or a drawing. It was 411 pieces of a collection that was one of a kind.
Did anybody make you an offer? Did anyone offer to buy them from you?
Not at that time, because I pretty well made it clear that I was not interested in considering any offers at that time. And I set out to find a printer or a print shop that could actually print one or two of these for me. And I came up on the Fairfield print shop just on the outskirts of Birmingham, and Mr. Wright was the owner and printer there. And he told me to bring one to him, and he would show me how it could be printed. Well, upon carrying what I considered one of the most important plates of all to him, it was a collage representing about 8 pieces of Rayfield's work, all collectively illustrated on this one plate. Mr. Wright walked back to an old wet mop sink, picked up a brass bristle brush, holding the printing plate in his left arm, began to take his right hand and just literally scrubbing the printing plate. And I like to have had a coronary. I could just see him scratching up and wiping out the image. And I screamed at him, "What are you doing?" And he tried to put me at ease, assuring me that he was not going to damage it, that he was simply cleaning off some of the surface corrosion. Well, upon completing his task, he rolled the plate with printer's ink, laid it in what's called a proof press, and drew the overhead roller across it. And to my amazement, off came the most gorgeous, beautiful print that you could dream of.
You're listening to The Story. Alan Dura later bought his own press and printed images of all 411 plates. And then he went looking for the actual Rayfield buildings.
My brother, Jim Dura, and Stephen Lightsey, my friend, and I spent hundreds, literally hundreds of hours at the Birmingham Public Library on old microfilm and going through old periodicals trying to find mentions off Rayfield. In some cases, we had a street address. So Steve and I particularly spent hours and hours and hours driving throughout Birmingham and the surrounding areas, checking out addresses. There was one building particularly that was of great interest. We had a printing plate of a three-story building with some side windows and a banister-type front porch deck on the second level. And we assumed that we would never be able to identify that building. Well, we had an address for a Dr. Strawbridge residence. So we drove out there to the address, and lo and behold, here was a perfect match to the printing plate that we had been thinking we would never identify. So we took current pictures of that, and it was very good that we did so, because it wasn't but a few years later that that building was demolished. And if it had not been for the pictures that we made and what little bit of information we had, the rest of the information about that building probably would have been lost forever.
Alan, what did it mean to you to track back through this man's life and his work and see the connections to your city?
It's hard to put into words as to what it actually meant to me. It was just so exciting. It was almost like panning for gold. Every bit of information that I found was like finding a golden nugget. I was ecstatic about every new bit of information that we came across.
Where are those plates now?
The plates are still in a large safe vault that I had purchased right after realizing the value and importance of these. So I still have all that.
So do you think that those plates will wind up someday at, I don't know, the Smithsonian or a university?
Very possible. I would love to see them in a museum of their own where they could be exhibited and displayed so the public could come by and visit them anytime that they wanted to.
I bet when you drive through Birmingham, even today, your eye gets turned by a building. If you know, you say, "That I bet that's a Rayfield building over there."
Constantly. My wife and I cannot make a trip without discussing that. My wife and I took a two-week vacation one summer and laid down about 3,000 miles covering Alabama, Mississippi, Florida, Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, and just in a wild, hard rush trying to look up all the different addresses and leads we had. And we would even work up into the late night. You could imagine just a elderly white woman and a white man pulling into what was predominantly a black area where people were standing around, and we walk up and say, "Hey, have you ever heard of Mount Zion Baptist Church located so-and-so?" And they said, "Oh, yeah, just down yonder a ways, you know. We'll go show you." As it turned out, it seemed like everyone was just more than glad to help.
Interesting, isn't it, that this pile of boxes that you were ready to bulldoze under an old barn would wind up changing your life in the way that they have?
It is. It has taken control of my life for the last 15-plus years and has virtually captivated every spare moment that I have had.
Alan Dura has written a book. It's called The Architectural Legacy of Wallace A. Rayfield. We'll have a link on our website at thestory.org. And the University of Alabama is currently making a documentary film about the architect and the discovery of the plates. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
Support comes from Red Hat, an enterprise open source company that works within communities to create technology the open source way. The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And this is APM, American Public Media.